This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this final show before the 2012 election, we'll look at how a superstorm may turn out to be nature's little October surprise. It certainly changed Romney surrogate Chris Christie's tune.
I've got devastation on the shore. I've got floods in the northern part of my state. If you think right now I give a damn about presidential politics, then you don't know me.
Also, the general state of the race as the clock ticks down. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gap Fest, how social media helped and in a few cases hurt during Superstorm Sandy.
It really was an incredible resource because I would type into the search field, Red Hook, or individual streets out here, and stuff would turn up. So it was a way of accessing grassroots reporting on the situation here.
And finally, the complicated life and troubled times of a Mormon heretic. We'll start with the Political Gap Fest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, the editor of Slate, here in Slate's D.C. headquarters. Off the road, snuggling close with me here is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from our one-woman New Haven bureau, Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
So on today's show, we're going to talk about Sandy and its impact, political and otherwise. We will talk about the final weekend of the campaign and what we each expect will happen on Tuesday. And of course, we will have cocktail chatter. So when political analysts talk about an October surprise, I think they usually mean like a sex scandal or maybe some sort of foreign policy triumph or some bit of political jujitsu. But we had a real October surprise this week with Hurricane Sandy coming along and totally throwing a wrench into the final week and a half of the campaign. The most devastating storm since Katrina, I think, right? Yeah, isn't it? I mean,
right.
it has.
Irene was bad, but this was worse.
Right. So it's paralyzed much of the Northeast, even now as we're taping. But the major damage was concentrated in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut, which aren't swing states, so it doesn't really matter, right, John?
Well,
that was a joke, by the way.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. We get to the late stage of the campaign. There's nothing that you can't say that people won't take offense at. And this was true before Sandy, but now in the course of, like, you know, at least 50 people dying, I'm conscious of all the people who are angry about the political analysis going on. On the other hand, this happened, you know, a week left to go in the campaign, and both campaigns were thinking incredibly carefully about how to play this. And so we can't deny that that was going on. And also because this is a frenetic period usually in the course of a campaign where they're spending a lot of time thinking about where physically to put the candidates. And so for to pull them off the campaign trail, it was a big deal because of all the things we talked about last week that a candidate visit to an important battleground state means and matters in terms of organization. So the fact that this wasn't in swing states, although, of course, you know, it's a huge news story, so it basically is in the swing states because they're all watching it.
So both the candidates obviously suspended their campaigns, but President Obama toured New Jersey with Republican Governor Chris Christie, the keynoter at the Republican National Convention, and I think arguably got what is perhaps the best moment he's had in the past 2 weeks. Let's listen to President Obama and Chris Christie together.
It's been a great working relationship to make sure that we're doing the jobs that people elected us to do. And I cannot thank the president enough for his personal concern and compassion for our state and for the people of our state.
Governor Christie, throughout this process, has been responsive. He's been aggressive in making sure that the state got out in front of this incredible storm, and I think the people of New Jersey recognize that he has put his heart and soul into making sure that the people of New Jersey bounce back.
Emily, what is the political impact of this joint appearance of President Obama and this governor who's criticized him profoundly in the past?
The political impact is like a liberal fantasy. I keep waiting for someone to wake me up. I can't believe how closely Christie is embracing Barack Obama. On a few levels, there's the obvious point that the election's next week and he's basically throwing Mitt Romney under the bus. And then there's the philosophical overtone, which is, gee, when you have a big storm and you really need the government, you actually want the federal government to come in and help. You want FEMA, discredited under George W. Bush, brought back to some good performance with Irene under Obama. And now, you know, Christie is the one tweeting the number of FEMA, the phone number of FEMA out there and telling people how great and responsive they've been. I just find it's mesmerizing, and I kind of still can't believe it's happening.
So, John, do you agree with Emily that this is liberal fantasy come true, at least in terms of the political impact? Is President Obama going to benefit from this?
I think liberals have much more interesting fantasies, but I do think this is a...
Not me.
Progressive. Those are the progressives, John.
Yeah. I think this is... Sure. If you're a fan of the presidents, this is great news because of everything Emily said. But I think also what's great about the conversation that this has initiated is that, you know, this is like real things happen, and this is why we have... government. And there are plenty of conservatives most who would say, well, of course you need to have a system that handles the way people are affected by a disaster like this. But then it gets into the argument, well, how is that system set up? Is it run through the states? Should there be a federal role? It's like Mother Nature sort of saying, you've had all of these stupid conversations in this election. Now we're going to present you with a real-time thing that's happening, and you're going to have to react and deal the way you would in real life, where you can't just bloviate. And guess what happens? A Republican governor who's beaten the out of the president suddenly is really grateful, and a president who's been given a lot of grief for not being a leader by the guy who's criticizing him is suddenly seen as a tremendous leader, not in some fake public stagecraft way, but by the guy who is the Republican talking head on the question of leadership. Right.
Wait, but can I interrupt you on that point there, the fake stagecraft way? Right. In what sense was what Obama did anything but fake stagecraft? I mean, he put the armature of FEMA to work, which of any president would have done. But he goes and does. You know, he looks at some ruined houses and the beach, and I mean, that's all total stagecraft.
Couple of things. One, in that case, just listening to what Christie said, that the president was on the phone to him, was immediately signed the disaster declaration order in a way that cut through, I guess, what is normal red tape and whatever. He was saying, based on what he needed from the federal government and the attention the president was paying directly to him, which was late night phone calls and administratively, that he felt like the president had done a great job. Then there's the stagecraft part of it, which I think there's some beneficial role of stagecraft for everyone, which is that it gets the FEMA phone number out there. It gives light to the suffering that's going on, which brings in relief dollars. And you know, so I think it's not just both of them getting themselves in front of the cameras, showing that they're doing something for their constituents.
So Emily,
it's also reassuring in a broader way. I think no matter who you are, a lot of Americans and just people generally want to feel faith in their leaders at desperate moments. And so if we had a Republican president, you would want him in there putting his arm around Democratic voters. It is a moment where people just want a sense that the government is doing its job.
Emily, why did Chris Christie do this? Why? He didn't need to go this far towards President Obama. Why would he have done it?
Well, the crass political assumption has been that he's thinking about his own chances in 2016 rather than Romney's in 2012. And I would love to hear what John thinks about that, because I just don't understand how there can't be consequences for him. If Romney loses next week and his embrace of Obama is seen as in any way bound up in that, doesn't that matter? I mean, is it just that in 4 years nobody will care anyway? I mean, won't there be some backlash on the right against Christie that could actually hurt him?
I guess a couple of things. One, I would say before answering that question, remember with Kathleen Blanco, with Katrina, there was all of this back sniping and all of it about the fact that she was a Democrat in Louisiana and the president was a Republican. They did not play well together at all in that crisis. And so
this is the governor of Louisiana. Right?
Yeah, the governor of Louisiana during Katrina. And that's why this is refreshing. I think you kind of got to take Christie at his word, which is like he wants to get this dealt with. And to the extent that it worked, working with a Democrat or Republican, a vegetarian or whatever is
he would
what he
not
wants
work
to get
with
done.
A vegetarian. That what guy would definitely not work
what he
with
wants
a vegetarian.
To get done. I think it also is his brand, right? So his brand is and his brand is more important to Mitt Romney if it's true than if it gets watered down. Now, the timing's a little funny here. So I mean, he's doing what's right Right, but he's doing what's right for his state and secondarily then what's right for him. If he doesn't get this dealt with in his own state, his future's over. So Mitt Romney comes a very, very, very distant third. I don't think any Republican can any Republican who criticizes him has to basically say, you know, when all these people were suffering, you didn't do the like incredibly political thing. You were thinking about the people you worked with. I think anybody who says that, and you could imagine, I mean, obviously Rush Limbaugh says that, but Rush Limbaugh, you know, is not going to. I mean, he calls the tune for a certain portion of the party, and that will come to be a problem for Christie if he runs for other reasons, because Christie is not going to meet the litmus tests of many parts of the party. But that will be on other issues. I think to the extent that Christie becomes and was the white knight of the party, it was for behaving exactly the way he behaved in this case. And his long-term prospects, if you buy the idea that Mitt Romney has done better and only has a shot at all at the presidency because he's moderated and because he's talked about working with Democrats, that's the strategy he's run. He hasn't run the strategy conservatives said he should run in the general election, which is run loud and proud as a conservative, be out there all the time talking about conservative principles. He's been more successful, particularly in the debate period, running as a moderate and moderate in tone. And that's like he's, you know, Chris Christie is the guy who does it actually in behavior in this case and working with the president.
That all makes sense to me up to the point of Christie saying, I don't care if Mitt Romney shows up here. I don't need him. You know, not in some even-handed way, giving him a chance to have some kind of photo op on the beach in front of the wrecked roller coasters. That seems really surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, that he probably went too far. Yeah, I mean, you know, when he said Mitt Romney should release his tax returns, that was probably a bigger problem for Romney than this. So he's
except
not
for the point about timing that you make, which is like this is a week away from the election. It's, you know, we had this whole idea of momentum going on. The Republicans seemed like they were picking up steam. They were at least making a good argument that was true. And now
right, but that doesn't die because of Chris Christie. I mean, Romney was already had either lost momentum or had stalled before the storm hit. What the storm did was rob him of 2 days of 3 days of a chance to kind of find a new gambit or push a new line of attack or do something to keep his forces excited and also continue making the contrast with other people. I don't think Chris Christie did anything to stall or stop Romney's progress, which was getting sort of coming to a stop on its own.
Let's switch to another Romney aspect of this of Sandy, which is a lot of Democrats and journalists, including our colleague Matt Iglesias, excavated what Mitt Romney had said about disaster relief and federal disaster relief during the Republican primaries. And it turned out that Romney, when asked about federal role in disaster relief, had given a kind of an ambiguous answer, but he certainly indicated that he thought that the states, this was something that should fall to the states, and that he used a phrase which I'm sure he regrets now, that it was immoral to spend money on certain federal activities at a time we're piling up national debt when these things could perhaps be done at different levels of government. I don't for a second think that Mitt Romney would dismantle FEMA or would substantially change federal disaster relief as president. He was saying that obviously as a pander to certain elements of his party. I do think there's a very satisfactory element here of if you're on the left of saying, look, this is the consequences of saying the kind of nutty stuff that you were forced to say in the Republican primary, and Mitt Romney should have to bear some burden for having even put this idea out there. Emily, or do you feel like that the hit that Romney's getting for having said this stuff is a hit that he deserves?
Yes. I mean, for me, this is what I want to see happen in more aspects of how Romney has moved to the middle, which is, well, but do you mean it in terms of how you're going to govern? And why should we trust that this is how you're going to govern, given how much you're enthralled to a party that is pulling you to the right? And so the check that these previous statements provide, to me, it's really important because the choice that Romney presents should be the choice that's how he is likely to actually perform as president. And maybe there's an argument, and John, maybe you'll make it, that I'm being too harsh on him and assuming that he's going to govern in the way that he ran in the primaries. You know, it's classic to move back to the middle, and he certainly was a moderate enough governor of Massachusetts. But in my heart, I just don't believe it. It's not because I think he truly believes that FEMA's budget should be slashed. It's because he is working with people like Paul Ryan and the people who are leading the Republican Party in Congress who are true believers.
Well, if you got to trust him, then you got to know kind of where he stands, and you get some view of that based on whether he stood in the same place on a variety of issues over time. And he obviously hasn't. His signature quality is that he's moved over time. So his lack of specifics make holding him to positions all the more important. Now, what the practical effect of this, and it seems to me if you're a liberal or a progressive, the thing that's probably making you tear your hair out, is that what a lot of undecided voters that I talk to, which is a different set than the total undecided voters, but this has obviously benefited Romney in a way. The voters that I talk to see this malleability and they are approving of it because they think, oh, he's not the guy of the primaries. This was seen not as a negative for Romney, but largely as a positive.
Coming up, a closer look at where the presidential race stands on this final weekend. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's ease into our next topic. The election is Tuesday. As it stands now, most forecasters think the Republicans will certainly hold the House of Representatives. Democrats are likely to hold the Senate. And President Obama has a narrow lead or is narrowly favored to win re-election. So, John, you're off the campaign trail, at least for the moment. As you look at the presidential race, what is Obama's victory scenario? What is Romney's victory scenario? And where do you sense it's heading?
Well, Obama's victory scenario is that he holds Wisconsin, Iowa, and Ohio, which if he holds those, he can lose and probably takes Nevada. And he wins. He gets over 270. And that, you know, right now he looks very strong in Ohio. Romney has been putting the heavy push in Ohio for the last 2 weeks, and it has not – the gains he saw after the first debate have not really materialized in Ohio. There have been some – so that's a big deal. If he can't win in Ohio, he's got to find somewhere else to win. And that's what's led to some of this talk about Pennsylvania and Michigan and Minnesota, all of which I think is foolishness. I think it's foolishness in that he doesn't really have a shot in those states. It may be desperation. And then at the end, it may just also be funny money, which is to say the campaigns have so much money that if they spend all the money on ads in the battleground states and paid all the staffers they can, if they have money left over, why not throw it into Pennsylvania where 96% of the people vote on Election Day? And if you could, you know, come up with a – you would have a chance, an incredibly slim one, to affect the 96% who are voting on Election Day, whereas if you put all your money in Nevada right now, a whole slew of people have already voted. So you have less chance of getting at them. But I think that all those three states are essentially not really in play. I mean, here's what happened. Romney had a real boost coming out of the first debate, and it dissipated at some point. He still has lots of energy at his rallies. He still has lots of support from Republicans, which in the Romney context is different than, you know, what it was really even before the first debate. His rallies and the Republican enthusiasm is real and genuine and far, far different than it was with John McCain.
So, Emily, do you agree with John? Pennsylvania is your home state. You obviously speak with no authority at all about it, but
precisely,
let's pretend.
I only
let's pretend
talk to six people who live in the city of Philadelphia
right.
regularly.
What did the Bazelon parents think about Mitt Romney's foray?
sisters are there too.
But is it your sense that, as John says, this is just a total feint? This is not real. This has no chance of doing anything, or that, you know, maybe there's something there. This is a backdoor victory.
Well, they have to have some kind of backdoor strategy, right? Some answer to the problem they're having in Ohio. So, you know, and also these leads that President Obama have, they're not overwhelming. And you could imagine something changing and shifting, or maybe they are systematically wrong. Maybe they're undercounting the likely voter percentage for Republicans in some way that makes these polls closer. My only prediction all along, which I'm sticking with in my anxious way, is that this is going to be a really close election. And so once you're there, when you look at the national numbers, you think, well, yeah, maybe we could expand the map. And they have to do something just to answer the Ohio question.
So I have a question about the swing states. If I remember, and John, I'm sure you're going to correct me. Probably you'll correct me, like, even before I finish this sentence. But if I remember back in 2004, there were about 20 states that people thought of as being conceivable swing states. Maybe a fewer, a little bit less than that.
In 2008,
it was more like a dozen. This time it's about seven.
Really, even now, you can argue that it's like three.
Yeah, so what I don't get, and actually I have a theory about this, so I do kind of get it. Why would that inherently shrink? I mean, I think part of it is that the country is just, there's more of the sorting, right? That red states are becoming redder, blue states are becoming bluer, and so there's just fewer states left in the middle. But it does feel to me like the country is sort of headed towards this world in which there's 240 locked electoral votes on one side and 240 locked electoral votes on the other side, and then they're just going to narrowly fight it out over a teeny little bit.
Yeah, it does feel like that. Everybody's gotten more polarized. But you know what's funny about this, and interesting, I should say, is that if you look at the Senate races, so if you look at states like Missouri, Indiana, Arizona, Montana, these are red states. These are places that Barack Obama would never set foot in. But they're Democrats who are likely to may win those Senate races, which seems to prove the idea that if you stick in one place, that some of these states that we consider as red are not as red as we think and blue as we think, Scott Brown in Massachusetts. But a presidential candidate can't do that, can't spend the time in the state in order to prosecute the campaign at the local level enough to pick up a win there. And so part of this is getting to 270. Part of it is,
if we got rid of the Electoral College, then you could go to these urban centers or to your strongholds in blue or red states, and it would jumble the map in a much more interesting way.
So, Emily, if Obama wins the election with a 270-plus Electoral College majority but does not win a majority of the popular vote, which is an unlikely but possible scenario— do you think that there's any chance it would now be a bipartisan move to ditch the Electoral College? Because you had, obviously, Al Gore lost the election with a popular majority in 2000. Do you think the Republicans, having lost, would say, you know what, we should reconsider the system?
I mean, the problem with this is that we need a constitutional amendment, and everyone is terrified of that idea, and it's laborious and hugely time intensive. And yet, if there's ever going to be a chance to do it, that would be the moment, right?
John, do you think there would be any movement, even if Republicans, if Romney wins 51% of the vote and gets 240 electoral votes?
I'm trying to think that right now the energy for getting rid of the Electoral College is mostly on the left, right?
Yes.
So you would want the Republicans to find some reason to come to Jesus, and that would be losing, but by winning the popular vote. So I guess you'd have a few AEI symposia probably on the question.
But it wouldn't happen, because obviously everyone knows
Maybe
you don't compete.
Could draft some constitutional amendments.
But you don't compete to win the popular vote. So if Obama wanted to win the popular vote, he would run a very different campaign. Well, he would campaign in cities. He would campaign in California. He would spend lots of time.
But maybe people will just think about how insane this is, that you win more votes and you lose. That is
undemocratic. Right. No, it is. The system does seem ridiculous. And people, I think you could get reasonable people would kind of say there's got to be a better way. The question then, though, is how to shove that through a political system that's just basically a mess and where ideas go to die.
All right, last question, and mostly for you, John, but Emily, you can have a swing at this. So on Tuesday night, I don't have any idea what to look for. I mean, I just basically look for whatever you tell me. So as I'm watching the returns, and as our listeners are watching the returns, what are clues that we're looking for that are going to give us a hint?
You want to look for two things, Ohio, basically, and you want to see if the president's margins in Cuyahoga County are huge. He won last time by 250-some-odd thousand votes. You know, is he crushing in Cuyahoga, and is Romney doing kind of well in Butler, Warren, Claremont, the counties that surround Hamilton County? Hamilton County is the swing county in the southwest corner of Ohio. That's the thing that you would – that's – Obama
awesome.
Won –
This is awesome, listeners.
Obama won Hamilton County.
I'm taking notes.
Obama won Hamilton County, which Bush had won two times. And so it's a swingy county. It's where Cincinnati is. If Obama wins that, that's a big sign. But you could imagine Obama winning Hamilton, doing well in Cuyahoga, but then Romney crushing it in – as I said, Butler, Warren, Claremont, and then up in Lake, in like Lucas and Lake and the northern counties along the top of it. Anyway, and then Virginia, you want to watch. So I'm thinking East Coast counties is going to tell you what's happening here. Northern Virginia, you want to watch if the president crushes in that blue area. Does Romney run up his vote in the southwestern portion of the state, which is all kind of rural and coal country? If the president's doing well in those states, or if Romney's doing well in those states, then you'll know how things are going to kind of play out down the map.
Awesome. That's the
that
last word on that
Worth
subject.
Worth the price of admission.
Let's turn to cocktail chatter. John, when you are downing shots of Red Bull and Jägermeister and it's an effort to prepare for your all-nighter on Tuesday night, what are you going to be logorrheically chattering about?
Well, my favorite new web app is the browser, which is it's a website that basically just curates good reading. I often find Slate articles there. I didn't know run in Slate, and I'm reading them, and I'm like, you know, this feels like a Slate story, and then there it is. Anyway, it's just got the like best sensibility, and it has been since I'm stuck so often, like waiting for another thing to happen somewhere. I just call it up on my iPhone, read some great transporting piece of writing, and it's been a great read.
Emily, what's your chatter?
Well, I hope everyone noticed that I was blocked out of talking about the Supreme Court this week, despite the fact that it was actually a super interesting week at the court by my colleagues.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought there was other news. I'm sorry. I thought there was a hurricane and a presidential election. Forgive me.
Right, exactly. How could this have happened? My favorite case this week involved two challenges to dog sniffing. This being the practice of police that when they're trying to determine whether someone has drugs or a bomb, but these cases were about drugs, can they bring the dog right up to your front door and have him sniff away at the marijuana that you are growing inside? Can this dog named Frankie sit on your porch for as much as 15 minutes while he's doing the sniffing? Or can Aldo go and sniff the handle of your truck and smell methamphetamine residue, leading the cops to discover the ingredients for meth inside, even though Aldo has no current certification? He's a dog without proper papers. This was just a very entertaining argument this week. And the main headline out of the argument on Wednesday was that Justice Scalia was very skeptical about Frankie sitting on that front porch. He thinks that Frankie smelling through your front door is like the cops using binoculars to look in through your front window. And he was urging the lawyer for the challenger to Frankie to actually not concede the idea that the cop, even without the dog, could be on your front porch at all, which was really interesting. It was not looking good for the dogs. David, what's your chatter?
My chatter. So I was cleaning my basement this weekend in preparation for the storm. Actually, no, I was just cleaning my basement. And I came across this wonderful thing, this medal that I was sent. I wrote a book, as I probably talked about a genius sperm bank some years ago. And as part of this book about a genius sperm bank, I wrote about the history of eugenics. Eugenics, of course, is the idea that you can, through breeding or in some cases through murder and sterilization, you can create a better human population. And after I wrote the book, a professor at the University of North Carolina named John Marks sent me a medal that was struck in the 1920s as part of something called the Fitter Families Contest. And so this medal, which we'll post pictures of, in the front side, it's a picture of, looks like two parents sort of handing a torch off to a handsome naked baby. And it says, "Yay, I have a goodly heritage." And then on the back, it says, "Presented by American Eugenics Society, Fitter Families Contest," with a laurel wreath on it. And turns out that in the 1920s, starting in Kansas, but then migrating to lots of other states, the state fair would have these things called Fitter Family Contests, where you would enter yourself in the same way you might enter your prize pig or your prize calf or your prize hydrangea in the agricultural fair. And you would submit to an examination by doctors and psychologists who would test you on your physical health and also on your mental health and your family history. And then these examiners would give you a grade, a letter grade, and your family letter grade. And the family which had the highest aggregate grade would win a silver trophy. But every individual who was over a B+, according to this scale that they created, would get this wonderful medal. And so I have this medal. I don't know that I would have won such a medal, but I'm sure you guys would have won such a medal.
No doubt.
Definitely, definitely. You just show them your excellent tennis game and they would have been like, that's a B+ right there.
That would be the end of it right there.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political GabFest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington, turning you over to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest. And joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And Slate's music critic, Jody Rosen. How's it going, Jody?
It's okay. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, we should say that we're all calling in remotely right now as a result of this cataclysmic storm. I'm calling in from upstate New York. Julia, you're in Upper Manhattan, am I correct?
Yes, both my home and the Slate offices are in the dead zone of Lower Manhattan, so I've relocated with some family uptown.
And here's where I should reassure our listeners that Dana Stevens has not been washed away by the angry floods. She was planning not to come in this week due to a vacation anyway. Jody has very nicely agreed to fill in. On today's program, Sandy and social media, did Twitter lead us or mislead us through the Frankenstorm? And then Mormon intellectuals and their complex relationship to their faith. And Jody, you're calling in from Red Hook.
Yeah, I'm calling from Red Hook, Brooklyn, in one of the few buildings out here that has power, which happens to be the building where I live.
And Red Hook was absolutely brutalized by this storm.
Yes, there was the place floods, I can tell you, having lived here, even in moderate rainfall, the streets flood significantly. And with the storm surge the other night, Red Hook was absolutely swamped, just inundated. You know, in places there were 12, 13 feet of water. There's a lot of suffering down here right now, a lot of damaged property, lost homes, et cetera. It's a grim scene.
And where were you riding out the storm? You weren't in Red Hook when the
Red Hook is in Zone A. It was one of the places that Mayor Bloomberg, you know, issued a sort of mandatory evacuation order. A lot of people here stayed. A lot of Red Hook residents fancy themselves hardy souls, and so a lot of people braved the storm. I took the evacuation order seriously and went to a friend's in Manhattan to ride out the storm. But there were a number of people who stayed. You know, thankfully there weren't any injuries, but there were some hairy moments.
And did you use social media? So you were someone who had a, you know, direct need to know what was happening location by location with the storm. Did you use social media? Did you use Twitter and Facebook to try and follow that as you were paying attention to the storm's track from your perch?
Absolutely. It was invaluable. In fact, it started for me early in the morning on Monday when, you know, before the storm came anywhere close to, I think the storm was, you know, several hundred miles south of New York at that point. But there was a picture that was tweeted out, a photograph that was tweeted out by someone who'd stayed behind. A friend of mine tweeted it to me. I then tweeted it to a fellow Red Hook resident, an acquaintance, Sam Sifton, who's the national editor of the New York Times. He tweeted it out, and then the photograph went viral. This was a vantage point on the kind of southern tip of Red Hook from up high, which showed the floodwaters already risen quite high. And I spent, you know, the next 12, 16 hours obsessively on Twitter and was able, it really was an incredible resource because I would, for instance, type into the search field Red Hook or type in Verona Street, individual streets out here, and stuff would turn up. So there was, it was a way of accessing kind of fine-grained block-by-block reporting, grassroots reporting on the situation here. Eventually, I was staying in Greenwich Village in Manhattan on East 12th Street. The power eventually went down. And when I lost Twitter, I felt like I was utterly cut off. Before I'd lost Twitter, I basically ignored traditional media. They just didn't do the job for me in the way that Twitter did. And afterwards, when I was reduced to listening to the radio, I felt like I was hearing news that was 5 hours old.
Yeah, I mean, I'll never forget when we were recording the Gabfest and the earthquake hit. And the studio started to shake, and we all went out into the common space of Slate. And I said out loud to everyone, I said, hurry, someone turn on CNN. And everyone turned and looked at me as if I had just said, snap on the wireless. You know, I mean, at that point, for most people of a certain age, the idea that you would turn on a television was completely obsolete. That was not at all where you were going to get information about what was happening. Everyone already knew what was happening because they were all on Twitter. Jody, in this regard, you're sort of a canary in the coal mine, and I'm more like a shareholder in the coal company. You know, I'm sort of the last to know. And but it really finally has come around even to me. I was never once tempted to turn on the television in order to figure out what was going on during this crisis. I was keeping up with it by and large on Facebook. That a really quite extraordinary transformer explosion in Lower Manhattan was something I learned about by watching YouTube. Never occurred to me to turn on the TV to see it. I mean, the internet and social media, it seems to me, have totally overtaken this. But Julia, one very definite trend that came out of this was the number of fakes and hoaxes and red herrings that went up on Twitter and via social media, including a somewhat now in retrospect ridiculous photo of the Statue of Liberty photoshopped with a kind of Spielbergian cloudscape gathering over it. What do you make of that? What do you make of the sort of signal-to-noise ratio when people are trying to navigate a crisis like this via the internet?
Well, there's been a bit of Sturm und Drang about it in the wake of the storm. You know, most notably, there was a prolific tweeter who goes by the handle Comfortably Smug, who deliberately put forth a bunch of misinformation that New York Governor Cuomo was trapped in the city, that Con Edison was going to shut off power preemptively to the entire island of Manhattan, a bunch of other sort of hysterical false news alerts that he put out. And he turned out to be a hedge fund guy who's actually managing the campaign of a Republican candidate for Congress from New York. And there was a lot of outrage and flack thrown at him. There were also some more innocuous bits of misinformation that circulated. A bunch of people were clued into a digital broadcast of a police scanner. And, you know, police scanners, as people who've relied on them for reporting know, are full of information, both false and true. So a report that Coney Island Hospital was burning circulated widely on the internet before somebody nearby said it's just a car fire. So it's very easy to jump to false conclusions based on the little fragments of information that you get from social media. On the other hand, yeah, I'm not sure that's something to be too concerned about. You get lots of misinformation from old media as well, and it seems like in the age of social media, you get more information, you get it faster, you can get it, as Jody says, more granularly about the areas that matter most to you. I think it's basically something to celebrate.
I agree. I did a search for Red Hook and saw that someone had tweeted that there was looting happening in the neighborhood. So I responded and said, where? Give me more details on this. Well, within a minute, multiple people tweeted back at me that this was an unreliable tweeter, the person who sent this thing out here. This was the person's first tweet ever, and that it was probably a hoax. So it seems to me that there's, if anything, you know, Twitter has this kind of built-in correction mechanism, which is that there's a lot of people out there.
Right, and as you say about misinformation getting corrected after Comfortably Smug was outed by BuzzFeed, you know, he quickly both apologized for his misinformation and resigned from the campaign of the guy he was working for. So, you know, these things don't sit and fester for too long.
But I was talking actually with a friend. He and I were talking about our experience of using Twitter and being Red Hook residents and looking for information during the storm. And we agreed that reading kind of composed prose, you know, nicely written thoughts about the situation in Red Hook, that wasn't the way we wanted to get this information. You know, that wasn't the right media experience given our needs and feelings. In fact, it was great to have this combination of terse to the point information and, for lack of a better term, feelings, you know, people's emotions, their experience, their immediate experiences of this in bite-sized pieces. And I got kind of the right tone, the mix of, you know, gallows humor and sort of elegies for the neighborhood and for, you know, restaurants we love that were suddenly swamped and information about who needs help where. Honestly, I found my love affair with Twitter increased over the last 48 hours.
Yeah. Well, before we move on, I want to say quickly that, Jody, you wrote one of the great pieces about the efficacy of social media in the contemporary age when your bike was stolen in Brooklyn, and you sent out basically an APB for it on social media. And how long did it take you to recover it?
3-4 hours, I think. I can't remember exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that felicitous piece by Jody about his stolen bike up on the show page. And our guest was Jody Rosen. Jody, thank you so much for coming to us from the flooded Red Hook, and please stay safe and dry.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, the plight of the Mormon intellectual. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. Mormonism is, in relative terms, a very new religion, and so its origins are uniquely transparent and available to study. At the same time, unable to cloak itself in the fogs of ancient custom and veneration, a new religion can be very sensitive about that transparency. This creates a conflict that defines and confines the task of Mormon historians, intellectuals, and scholars, and that is the subject of a new and tremendously well-reported and interesting and provoking piece by Slate's own Dave Haglund. David Haglund, I should say. David is the editor of Browbeat, the culture blog of Slate, and he is something called a Jack Mormon. David, why don't we start by having you explain exactly to our listeners exactly what a Jack Mormon is?
Well, a Jack Mormon is someone who has grown up in the church or been in the church for a long time and then left, but bears no ill will toward the church, which is distinct from the term ex-Mormon, which generally refers to somebody who has left and has become an opponent of the church, someone who's hostile to it.
And do you think you've preserved your status as a Jack Mormon in writing this piece?
I think so. It's definitely something that I wrestled with. My subject was a historian who was kicked out of the church about 20 years ago, and there were certainly times when I became very frustrated with what had happened to him. And, you know, that may have made me feel a little more antagonistic, but it's really intended more as a study of the Mormon culture, not as any kind of attack or expose.
Yeah, let me say I was being a little glib. I pick up absolutely no tone of ill will in the piece at all. It's really a remarkable piece of journalism. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that scholar and who he is? His name is Michael Quinn. What put you onto him, and what's his story?
Well, so in September 1993, six Mormons were excommunicated within a couple of weeks of each other, and they were dubbed the September 6 in the Salt Lake Tribune. And the story was picked up all over the country. The Times and the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times wrote pieces about it. And I was 15 at the time. I was growing up Mormon in Massachusetts and was vaguely aware of what was happening. I certainly heard the term September 6 and knew that something was going on with intellectuals in the church. And that's a community that my parents were a part of, and even though they didn't know any of the six well, they had friends in common. And so as the media has kind of gotten on to the subject of Mormonism the last couple of years, I got to thinking about what happened to those six people. And as I started looking into it, Quinn just immediately jumped out to me as a compelling figure. He has a PhD in history from Yale. He's really one of the more accomplished historians of Mormonism of the last 20 years. And he also happens to be gay, which I only learned as I started to do a little more research. He didn't fully come out publicly until about 3 years after he was kicked out of the church.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say the church's relationship to Quinn has been over the years when it became clear to them what the spirit of open inquiry would mean to them and the hierarchy and the history of the hierarchy?
Well, he first really antagonized them in 1981, well before he was kicked out. He gave a talk that was called On Being a Mormon Historian. A couple of high-ranking church leaders, two members of what are called the 12 Apostles, had themselves given talks saying that Mormon teachers and historians need to be careful about the kinds of things that they choose to write about and to focus on, because some things in the Mormon past are not faith-promoting. And Quinn gave a talk saying that this was just, you know, a horrible mistake, that even if you read the Bible and the Book of Mormon, you'll see that the prophets in those books are depicted as human. It's not all hagiography. Historians today have no less responsibility in his mind to dig deeply into the stories of the people who make up the church. And so he gave this talk, and he criticized these apostles by name. And then Newsweek ran a piece about that talk, which generated some controversy in Utah. So his problems with the church started then, and they just continued for the next 10 years. He continued to write historical articles about, for instance, polygamy and the way that it was sort of very awkwardly given up by the church at the end of the 19th century. He wrote about the politics of the Mormon prophet Ezra Taft Benson, who was a John Birch Society supporter, sort of a radical anti-communist conspiracist. So none of this sat very well with, I should say specifically, certain members of the kind of top leadership of the church.
And so when he was actually excommunicated in the early 90s, how uncommon or common was that at the time, and how was it received, how was news of it received within the larger church?
Well, it's not as uncommon in the Mormon church as it is in some churches. Excommunication has played a role throughout the history of the church. It was actually the only way one could leave the church until 1989. But it was distinct in that there was a group of people and that they seemed to be targeted.
So how would you say the church's relationship to historical inquiry has changed in the years since Quinn's excommunication?
Well, my sense is that it's changed hugely. I went out to Salt Lake this past summer and went to something called the Sunstone Symposium, which is a gathering of people studying and talking about Mormonism. And I talked to a lot of Mormon historians, especially younger Mormon historians. And their sense is that about 10 years ago, you know, several years after 93, there was sort of a thaw. And I think the internet has a lot to do with that, because there was a time when leaders of the church really felt like they could control what information was available about the church. And that's just not the case anymore. Anyone who wants to can Google polygamy or Joseph Smith seer stones, for instance, and find all kinds of interesting stuff out there. And I think also the people who are at the top and who are making these decisions have become more open and have decided that the church can take it, essentially.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, one obvious context for your piece is, you know, we've got an election coming up on Tuesday with our first Mormon nominee for presidency from a major party. Is there anything we can learn about Mitt Romney and the tradition that he comes from and how that tradition has changed in the modern era?
Well, you know, I struggled with that as I wrote the piece and ultimately left that question in some ways up to the readers. I think that probably the most direct way it applies is that sometimes when Romney himself is asked about the church, you will see a kind of delicacy that he uses to try to answer those questions. So, for instance, he was asked about the church's policy with regard to blacks and the priesthood. Until 1978, the church would not give priesthood to black men. And Romney was an adult well before that policy was changed. And when asked about that, I mean, the right answer is it was wrong. It was a mistake. But if you go back and look at his answer, it's a little more couched, you know, like things have changed. I think there's a hesitancy on the part of a lot of Mormons to publicly criticize the church. And that's really the backdrop for the story of Michael Quinn as well. You know, Mormons have been in many ways a persecuted minority for much of their history. You know, in the 19th century in particular, they were subject to an extermination order in Missouri. The federal government started cracking down on the church in the late 19th century. And that kind of feeling of persecution persists. And it makes it, I think, difficult for a lot of Mormons to talk openly in public with non-Mormons about the church and its past. And I think you see that sometimes with Romney. At the same time, I should say, I mean, I don't think that Romney's Mormonism disqualifies him in any way for the presidency, and I find it frustrating when I see that argument made. Part of the reason I wrote this piece was to show a community of Mormons who are intellectual, who many of whom are liberal, who are questioning, who are serious, and they're also faithful. Michael Quinn, for everything that has happened to him, still has a literal belief in the Mormon Church and in Joseph Smith and the rest of it. And, you know, they're smart people who have these beliefs, and they are not all conservative. They are not all unquestioning.
All right. Well, David Hagelin, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your remarkable piece of journalism, A Faithful Apostate, that should be up on Slate.com if it hasn't been too waylaid by Hurricane Sandy. But look for it. It's a tremendous piece of writing. David, will you stick around and endorse with us?
I'd be happy to.
Ah, fantastic. Julia, let's start with you. What do you have?
So I spent the evening of the hurricane watching broadcast news, first on TV until the power went out, and then the CODA, which we had pre-downloaded on an iPad for in our early hours of darkness. And broadcast news is, of course, the great TV journalism movie from, I think, the early 80s, starring Holly Hunter as a frazzled TV news producer, Albert Brooks, and William Hurt as the smarty pants reporter and the blonde bluff kind of vacuous anchor. You can guess who played who. And this movie is as good as everyone says it is, but it is also sort of a remarkable portrait, I think, of how gender politics have changed, at least in Hollywood, since the early 80s. Holly Hunter plays this woman who is genuinely principled, genuinely committed to her work, and both her principles and her commitment to her job get in the way of her romantic life, and we're supposed to be okay with that. I haven't seen a movie about a woman where her commitment to work isn't viewed as a mere obstacle that she must learn to ameliorate, mediate, and overcome on the path to marrying Matthew McConaughey in years. And, you know, I just was stunning to see how different. I mean, it made me think, when is the last time I saw a movie out of Hollywood that dramatizes and in some ways romanticizes a woman's insane commitment to her job? And I'd kind of like to see more of them.
Mm. It is such a good movie, I have to agree, with that incredible cameo by Jack Nicholson as the national anchor. It's just terrific.
And also, it just made me feel like Aaron Sorkin is spending all of his time ripping off this movie in all of his shows that he's ever produced and in most directly Newsroom, and I just think he should rip it off more and better. They're just if he's going to rip it off, he should just go deeper and stronger and better, and particularly in the portrayal of women, which is the big problem with Newsroom.
Agreed, and well put. All right, David, what do you have?
Well, there's a singer-songwriter who I love and who's been around for a while but seems distinctly underappreciated. Her name is Katel Kainegg, which is K-A-T-E-L-L K-E-I-N-E-G. She lives in Ireland. I think she's of Welsh descent. And she had a little bit of attention in the 90s. She put out an album called Jet, which is great, on Elektra, I think. And she used to play live shows with Jeff Buckley, I think. And if you like Jeff Buckley, if you like Joni Mitchell, I'm sure you will love her music. It's terrific. Jet is probably the place to start. And specifically, I'd recommend the song Leonore, about a deceased surrealist painter. But all her albums are great, and I wish more people listened to her.
Is that about a real deceased surrealist painter, or
yes,
imagined?
Yes, Leonore Fini. Yeah, it's an obituary sort of for her. And I believe she had died not long before the song was written.
Fantastic. All right. Well, this week I'm going to endorse an essay by Donald Hall. It's on the New Yorker's website, and it's about poets and live readings given by poets and the history of that phenomenon. And also Donald Hall, who's now in his 80s, his own personal history as someone who goes on the road to read poetry on college campuses and various other places. And he gets at what is so distinctly weird about the phenomenon along the way to recounting several kind of not just juicy, but sort of tangy and weird anecdotes about what it's like to encounter fans of poetry on the road. It's really actually I'm not doing it justice. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. You can tell it's a piece of sort of anecdotal memoir written by a poet. It's written with enormous care. It's a fun read. I don't want to make it sound like homework, but highly recommended. Anyway, David, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Julia, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast version of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week. She joined the cafe meetings of Breton and Cartier-Bresson, Maxton, Spolilois, Georges Bataille. Their misogyny really irritated her, but she wasn't one to let it cry.